So actually, before we start the show, I just want to say one thing. Last week on the show, I said that I was going to play the entire song, I Love My Car,
yeah.
By Belle and Sebastian, and I didn't do it. I forgot to do it. In fact, I didn't even listen to the whole show. You were waiting for it.
I was totally waiting for it.
And I forgot to do it. So I'm going to play it now before we start the show proper. Then everyone will have heard it, and then we can just start the show.
So you're going to play the entire song right now?
I'm going to play the entire song right now.
All right, I'm going to go do my taxes.
You can go do your taxes. It's exactly. Not that long a song. Your taxes aren't due till next year.
Yeah.
I know that for a fact.
All right, I'm off.
So here we go. Hi, everyone. Welcome to Sneaky Dragon. My name is David Dedrick.
It's Ian Boothby. Quick question. Can I can I deduct illegally downloaded songs?
You can, they're not illegally downloaded. I have not legally paid to use that song for 251 times, but I have legally purchased it 2 times.
Okay, sounds good.
So I think that puts me 2 times ahead of the something.
The man.
The authorities. The people who keep tell us, my internet provider, to send me warnings that someone is illegally downloading in my house. It's not necessarily me, but someone is using my ISP or whatever it's called. Could be my cat, who loves Pretty Little Liars and is downloading it, season 7. Hi, everyone.
Yeah, we have guests. Introduce our guests.
Yes, I was going
to. Okay, go ahead.
Because we got off track. And then
I put it back on the track. Okay.
And now I'm going to introduce our guests this week. Actually, first I'm going to introduce Heather L. Gilbraith, who you may know her from her questions from the episode 250. She also does a fabulous comic called Sable and Aster. And she also does the Critical Hit Show comics that Ian has written. One of them, right?
I wrote one.
And so you can, we'll post with the show descriptions, we'll have links to those things. And she also does colorful snowflakes, or snowflakes that you can make colorful.
Yes, things you can color in. They are black lines that you can print in color. That's
there you go.
Pretty much.
And you're the first person who's ever done that.
Yes, I pioneered this.
Pioneered colorful snowflakes.
I'm a little late to the game. I kind of leaked my secrets about, like, you know, 5 or 6 years ago, and now it's a big industry, and I'm so upset about that.
Yeah.
Damn it, bastards.
So, anyway, welcome to the show.
Thank you. I'm so happy to be here. You have no idea.
And also visiting is Pia.
Hi.
Pia, of course, is the artist, well-known artist of Why the Last Man, and more importantly, 4-time, maybe more, maybe 5-time, Sneaky Dragon guest.
I think it's maybe 4, but I spent a lot of time when I was drawing in here.
That's right, interjecting.
In the background and interjecting and doing fact-checking.
So there you go. Like CNN, many appearances then. Many appearances.
Yeah, it really sounded like my conscience every so often.
Mm-hmm.
Just yelling, you know, but my conscience being incredibly intelligent with a lot of good
Be
facts.
Right! Be right! Yes. So we're so often wrong, and yet proud of it. So
so the topic today is women in comics.
Guys,
could you imagine what shitheads would be if that was the topic? I say that to all you shitheads out there who are thinking of doing that as a topic for a future podcast.
Pia, don't you think we should kick these guys out?
Yeah, absolutely. We'll just take over the podcast.
Do your own show.
Yeah, we'll do it today. I'll talk about the spinal cord surgery I had a kid. Everybody really grossed out.
Oh, nice.
No.
Yes. Girls and their spinal cord surgery talk. Blah, blah, blah.
Yes. How does it feel? Okay. Well, let's talk. Well, let's go around about that in a way, though, because I think that Heather's written a couple of Facebook posts that I thought were very interesting about creativity and creative blocks, which is something that I'm very familiar with. And I'd say all of us here, except for Ian, are very familiar with creative blocks.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know why Ian doesn't experience this problem, but
he gets blocked out, but then I give him a good swift
and I go, "Oh, my spinal problems!" And then she tells her story again.
I think I need a Pia to.
Everyone needs a Pia, quite frankly. Also, when you see her like on the other end of the couch, like doing this amazing work, it's just, okay, I gotta keep up.
Well, that's funny you say that because personally, I think I would find that demoralizing rather than. Because I thinking back to when we used to do our own self-published comics, or when I did a self-published comic, and Ian did dozens of self-published comics, I actually found that really intimidating that you were so so fertile, so productive, and I was stuck in this kind of endless Mobius loop. And so it was, to me, I think for my personality, I would find that actually harder to work with someone who is really productive and really going, I would tend to sit back then.
Are you a do it anyway type person though? I mean, that's the thing is like people get blocked, but you just do it anyway and you don't, you know, you feel how you feel and you feel shit. And occasionally people ask me about it. How are you feeling? Ah, I feel this script I'm writing is the unfunniest thing I've ever written in my life. I just wrote the unfunniest script I ever wrote in my life this weekend.
Yeah.
Cause you know, I was going, I need to pay the bills. Yeah. Okay. So I got to get this done. Okay. Oh, well that's a piece of shit. Put it out there. I'm going to be called a fraud. But you do it anyway. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, over time, you look back on it and go, I guess that's okay.
That's definitely something I still need to learn how to do.
Yeah. Yeah, that really is. I mean, I think if there's any secret, yeah, I've ended deadlines. The conversation early. Deadlines
will do it.
Deadlines are doing that you have to keep. And, sure. And yeah, the do it anyway, you know, hand in the thing that's 60% good.
Well, I would say that doing Sneaky Dragon I has changed me a lot in terms of how I work, quite a lot. So I'm way more productive than I ever was when I was younger. Which is upside down as far as most people's creative.
Definitely.
Like most people, if you listen to older cartoonists, they're like, get it done when you're young because you're not going to have the energy when you're older. But for me, it's been an update. Alex Robinson just wrote that the other day. So, and I know Dave Simms said that as well, that it's much harder. It doesn't just feel as productive as he did when he was younger, when he could just produce pages like crazy.
There's energy, but there's also, maturity of work too. Mm-hmm. I mean, there was a lot of times when I was younger and I was producing a lot because I had to get a deadline done in someone else's story.
Yep.
And I had some stories in my head, but none that I really wanted to tell, nothing that I had to say. But as you get older, you get the ideas kind of solidified. Mm-hmm. Like, oh, this would make a really good story. This has meaning. So, you know, I think you get that over time.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. And then also you get, with all the experience, it becomes easier to put it down. Whereas when you're young and you've got a gazillion ideas, but you know, all you can come up with is this 12-volume epic. It's like, it's never going to get done.
Mm-hmm. I definitely have one of those. Yeah. Started when I was 16.
Yep.
It went up to 90,000 words. I think I wrote 20,000 words in one weekend. Ow. And it's terrible.
Is this a novel that you're writing?
It was something I started when I was 16, and it was just... I don't know if you guys have ever had this happen, but, you know, have that thing you were good at when you were little and got a lot of, like, you know, people trying to push you to do it and to be better at it. A lot of encouragement.
For me, masturbating.
Right. Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you. Welcome to the show.
Yeah. No, this is what I was hoping for. get all that. Okay. It was just...
I love to derail things.
I wrote my first story when I was about, like, my first not associated with school mm-hmm. story when I was 9 years old.
Okay.
And my mom and my teachers were really into it, mm-hmm. got me in touch with a published writer and, you know, did pen palling back and forth, and then had a moment in, like, grade 9 where my confidence in my writing ability was completely shot. It was due to tests, you know, like provincial mm-hmm. exams. There was this stupid creative writing exam where you didn't have any chance to prepare. There was no notes you could bring in. It was just, like, 2.5 hours, sit down, write a story that was at least this many pages, a creative story. And then they took it off and whisked it away. And then a week or two later, you got your mark back. And I nearly failed it.
Mm-hmm. Wow. And, I totally cheated that.
Yeah?
Yeah.
How do you cheat it? I need to know.
You make up a story ahead of time in your head. And then they tell you when the test comes in, okay, you have to incorporate a ring to this story. Like, oh, yeah, easy. The ring in it. And then draw, and then just write it out as you plotted it in your head the day before. It's just, don't. And no one cares about those exams. So it's
no,
really all
of
right.
course not. Yeah. But
it was a spirit breaker for
for 14, nice job, 15-year-old, you know, it was kind of like, ah, shit. And, you know, everybody else, or there are other people in my class that were not considered creative types who, you know, did really well on it. And that completely was just like, oh, I'm not as good at this as I thought I was. I'm obviously a fraud, a phony, et cetera, et cetera. And so I would do the thing where I would start stories and then immediately abandon them. And I had like 50 or something, you know, word files with like 2 pages written in them. And I got so frustrated that finally I sat down and I was like, right, no plots, no nothing. I'm just going to sit down and write whatever the hell comes to my head. Stream of consciousness type thing. And you know, just like put myself in a story. I started it thinking, where would I want to be right now? And I thought, oh, I want to be, you know, pretty much where I was living at the time, which was in the Fraser Valley, surrounded by mountains and, you know, rural Farmville type area. And I just put myself on a literal farm in a fantasy setting. And then this story emerged and I kept writing it for years and years until it turned out to be 90,000 words. And it's terrible. But it was really...
It felt good to do.
Oh, it did. Yeah, it felt so good to do.
Yeah, that's probably a real good step.
Yeah, it was really great. And then, of course, I, you know, graduated high school, got out into the real world, and then just completely lost, you know, my writing kind of habits or whatever. And that's something I'm still struggling to get back, is trying to get into some sort of headspace where writing is something that I do, not only because I have to, but also for fun or, you know, that kind of thing. It's ridiculously hard.
What was your last huge blocks for everybody? Something that you've got going on right now that you just, you can't push through? Because I got a story that's on my drawing board at home that's just surrounded by junk, and the junk gets higher and higher. And what stopped me was, and Pia's tried to help me through this, is like, I just can't draw it adequately. And I want to draw it. And so there's a scene that takes place in this one area, like there's like a bunch of school lockers and people are walking by them, and I can't draw them well. And I'm like, ugh, it just kills me and I can't get past it.
Is there a way to work around having to have that much detail that you can't put into it?
It's pretty basic, but I think I need that. And there's also a scene that's a real reveal scene in this giant room with a bunch of stuff, and I'm not able to pull that off yet. And it's so jarring to me how not what I want is the art that I'm putting down, that it stopped me halfway through, though it's a story I really want to tell.
No,
so
I can understand.
That's my current thing that's hanging around that's blocked. Mm-hmm. Yourself.
Mine is a story you wrote, actually, and you put in a multi-person dialogue scene into it with six or seven people talking, and I don't know how to draw that. And I realize that I've always written for myself to have maybe two people at the most, or maybe three people talking. Mm-hmm. In a scene, so I don't have to worry about blocking so many people. And I don't know how to draw. Like, I just feel like I've actually been studying it recently, like just looking at books with a lot of people talking, trying to figure out, like, so it's okay to draw the back of the head, and it's okay, you know what I mean? Like, so you're just worried. You want to make sure people recognize the characters, but at the same time, you're like, how do we introduce characters? And you're showing backs to the heads, and it's really thrown me. So once I get in a block like that, it takes like a huge river building up behind it to finally force that block, and then, you know, and then I kind of get washed and don't, you know, go with the current or whatever.
Have the dam break.
Yeah, and then you know, then I can start going again. But
the fiber kicks in.
Yeah, and I wish I could learn to be someone like Dave Stevens, the artist who did The Rocketeer, where he would just if he was stuck on a page, he'd just put that page aside and he'd go on and do
the next one.
Yeah, and in fact, he had finished the entire Rocketeer except for one picture of the pug that's in the story. And that just sat on his drawing board for months and months, and it bothered all his studio mates that he has almost done this story, but he couldn't finish this drawing of the pug, and he couldn't get it to where he wanted it, and he just kept being put off and put off until finally, whatever happened, he just got it done, and then that was finished, and it published. Obviously, it was a big success, but what stopped him from finishing it was this one dog, and I think that's not a... I don't think it's an uncommon thing that, you know, you hit this kind of wall, and whether it's a real block or a psychic, you know, a physical, you know, some sort of psychological block that, you know, if I don't finish this, no one can judge me. You know, that kind of thinking that's possibly there.
It's better to have a hit drawer than a mediocre hit title.
That's exactly.
Yeah, yeah, I know that fear. That's a big fear.
Yeah, that's a big
fear. Have you tried Wally Wood's 22 panels?
I should take a look at that.
Yeah, because when you're doing talking heads, you need something like that. Mm-hmm. Just do different angles, different
changes.
And
what is that actually?
That's, yeah, tell people who don't know.
This is something that my editor gave me my first day working on Y, and she said, stick this on your board. And I'm like, I did, and I still have it around somewhere. It was Wally Wood.
Yeah.
He got really fed up of having all these scenes of like just talking scenes, and he had a lot of people, new artists, come to him like, how do I deal with this talking scene? I can't make it dynamic. Mm-hmm. So he created this thing, 22 panels that always work.
Yeah.
And it's just a different, it's a whole bunch of, it's a good, like, yeah.
22
panels of, but different angles. So you can have like a silhouette, or you have a face on, or above shot, or low ground shot, or, you know, gray tones. You know, it just gives you, puts your head in the place where you need to be when you're
sure stuck. And just a way to get you out of, like, artists who are in a rut where you just have talking heads rather than just having two heads, have a way of silhouette from behind, above, just a way to add some dynamics to your art.
It can be really intimidating, especially when you have a very complex setting and mm-hmm. you think you have to like do everything, you know, magically, like to fit and make it sense. It's like, no, you're making the panel make sense. So it doesn't have to be absolutely perfect. Do the best you can. You can even have some empty panels, you know, if that moves the dynamic forward.
Interesting.
I've always kind of been nailed in my head, you know, when you're doing a page, you find your biggest panel with the most stuff happening in it, and you focus all your energies on making that one really pop. And then all the panels panel around it supports that panel.
Mm-hmm.
So then you don't have definitely. To go crazy putting details in every single one. Even though my editor, when I started, was like, every panel's got to have a background. And it was like, that really hurt for after a while.
Yeah.
And and Ian can tell you that there were times he hated that advice because he saw how much I tried to make sure every panel had something. And after a while, you kind of, it's like, no, you can do shorthand. Work around this.
Sure.
As long as it's a balanced page. You don't want to have it so empty that you're lost.
Sure.
Those like supporting pages, like, or the that center panel, that kind of that main panel has to just, that guides the whole page.
Yeah. Yeah, look at someone like Jaime Hernandez, who so much of his pages, you know, you think how beautiful his art is, but so much of it is suggested through lines and some blacks, you know, that have been carefully.
Like or anybody, yeah. Or anybody, yeah. Because it was a Vertigo book you were doing. And I still want to hear your blocks stuff everywhere. but like, you look in the Vertigo books, and if you find half of the panels have backgrounds, that's amazing.
Yeah.
And then even look at, you know, mainstream comics, like Marvel and DC, you know, they all kind of come from Kirby and Ditko. And, if Kirby drew a background, it would just be a make-em-up crazy background.
This is the thing. A lot of people are but never. Kirby was a master, and Kirby did this many pages, and he was able to crank out that stuff. And it's like, well, yeah, but look at what he's done.
He knew where to spend his energy.
Yes.
Yeah.
He has those great splash panels or splash pages that just jump, and he puts everything into it. But then there's like a dozen more panels with nothing.
Mm-hmm.
But he balances it so well, you don't notice. But if you look, you go, oh my God, this is why he was so productive.
Yeah.
So,
and also his anatomy wasn't exactly spot on either.
His anatomy was gestural.
Yeah.
So he was able to get, this is what I suggest for any artist starting out, is make sure you learn gestural drawing. You want to get just the basic essence of a movement, of a figure, of a pose.
Okay.
Then that saves you so much time. If you want another artist to look at is John Romita Jr.
Okay.
And he does all this stuff on Spider-Man and Daredevil. It's like, it was just beautiful gestural lines. He has this big bulky frame of Daredevil's back, for instance, because it's a boxer. And you think, he's muscly and he's heavy. One single line down the middle. There's no crazy muscles. It's just there's the
suggestion of the outline
this,
and
silhouette of the muscle, and there's that one center spine line, maybe some shoulder blade suggestion, but it gets everything you need figured out. That's why learn your anatomy, learn your gestures, and that's all you need. You don't have to replicate life perfectly. You're trying to you're trying to capture an essence of what you see.
Cartoon realism. Yeah.
And now things are blocked on. Heather, you don't have to specifically tell the story because you know you don't want to reveal it or what happened.
I was just thinking about the gesture drawing thing, and I think I got a lot of practice doing gesture drawing by trying to draw horses when I was a kid. Because horses are so big and have so many moving parts, and sometimes I will just sit in my sketchbook and do little scribbles of just like, you know, stick horses, but trying to get that feeling of movement, that feeling of balance on, you know, whatever foot is taking the weight in a certain stride, or, you know, like that really helped to try and get me into a mode of sketching where, you know, you just try to get the pose down and then you build it out from there, and it's not like starting with like a wooden mannequin and then trying to draw the forms. It's, you know, getting the line in there and also studying, you know, I'm a huge Disney fan, so I would look up old model sheets and things and show, and they always had very dynamic lines through them.
And so much weight in those drawings too.
Yeah, like, and not so afraid to squash and stretch, not afraid to push things if you need to. Mm-hmm. Like, not everything has to be 100% perfectly, you know, anatomically correct, and I just love that.
There are tutorial manuals online from the Disney artists have.
That's right.
You can find them, look through there's like a 7-pager just on panel layouts, and it's brilliant. It's like, it's all Huey, Dewey, and Louie there, but it makes so much sense how to set your camera, how to do it, you know, like to make things dynamic and how to avoid mistakes. And it's things like that. I mean, especially animators have got this, and Disney is really good at constantly getting their artists to update. So they're always having tutorials, they're always having workshops, you know, they're bringing animals in for you to look at, you know, so you're not just studying. Again, I love those little mannequins and things, but they're completely useless.
Yeah.
Don't use them. Just look at life
unless you know that, like, say if you have a horse mannequin, unless you know how a horse actually looks while it's doing something.
There's so many terrible horse mannequins out there.
I'm so sorry for that horse mannequin I got to do.
Oh, well, it's just a decoration in your house.
No, it's fun. They're really pretty, and they can help you remind things like where joints go and all that.
Yeah.
But when it comes to what you want to capture, emotion of something, you have to really see it move.
Mm-hmm.
I remember back in, sorry, I keep interrupting your story.
No, it's fine.
Back in Seattle, I just...
We don't do that on this show.
No.
Yeah.
And another thing.
There's an artist who was a mentor for me for a really long time, Moritat, and he could not do horses. He still can't do two horses. So every now and then it's like, yeah, can we do a horse? And it's like, yeah, yeah, that's fine. And it's just, it's, I got like a lot of dinners out of that.
Well, especially when he was working on the Jonah Hex comic for a couple of years.
It was hilarious.
It's like, there's a few horses in that thing.
Yeah.
And you know, when they ask him, can you do this? Oh yeah.
Oh yeah. So I'm sending him horses and stuff every now and then. It's like, don't try this. Yeah. So it's, but everyone's got their thing.
Yeah.
But animation's a great place to look at.
Oh yeah. I'm mm-hmm. deeply indebted to the late Michael Sporn, who had a blog called the Michael Sporn's Animation Splog, and it was just full of his like stories about the work he'd done in industry, but more than that, his collection of model sheets, his collection of cells, of just analyzing scenes in different movies and going like shot by shot through things, and he worked with Richard Williams.
Is it still around, that blog?
I hope it is. I hope somebody's kept it, because it was just one of the, when I was, you know, a formative artist on the internet back in the day, you know, around 2008, you know, that was incredibly, incredibly helpful to me. And I still have so many of those model sheets saved on my computer. And I remember a while ago, I printed them all out and had them pinned on my wall, and they're just amazing things.
Interesting. I have those big giant books that, I can't remember, do you know what I mean? Like the Something Foster, was it, or what?
Yeah, Walter Foster.
Yeah, those. There's a couple of animation.
Preston Blair books.
The Preston Blair ones. Yeah. He was a Disney guy, so they're quite.
Almost every animator I know has those books just for the mouthing the letters. You know, about mouthing the shapes of words.
Yeah.
You know, it shows you exactly how to do it. Here's walk cycles.
That, but
with a big guy.
But also, he really liked a lot of bounce in his in his movement and stuff, and that's. You know, like I say, that weight is something that is hard to put into drawings when you first start drawing, is to draw characters that actually look like they're standing or sitting on something rather than just sort of floating in midair, you know?
Yeah.
Which is very easy to draw. It's easy to draw a person and then put a chair underneath them, but you haven't made them look like they're sitting, you know? So it's hard work.
If I could recommend my favorite How to Draw Animals books, there's one called The Art of Animal Anatomy by Ken Hultgren. That just has the most beautiful ink drawings in them, very gestural, full of movement, and it's got very little words, actually. He explains everything through drawings and shows you step-by-step how to break things into forms, and it was just such a great book and was so useful to me growing up, and I'd recommend it to anybody. It's so great.
not Robert Bateman? Call yourself a Canadian?
Well, Bateman's nice, but he's doing stills.
Yeah, this third is stills. I know, I'm just kidding.
Beautiful paintings, but I don't know if he could animate or do it.
I don't think. No, and actually they're kind of wooden. I'm not a big fan of his art. I think they're a little stiff myself. But so you never said what you're, you never fashion. Admitted your, you never admitted your block.
My block. Well, I was thinking about it, and I think I just haven't really been making a lot, like not since school. And for school, you know, it pushes you through a lot of blocks because you have deadlines and things. But I think definitely Sable and Aster was the last thing that I've definitely bonked my head on. I'm still, you know, struggling to get through it because it started as a very simple idea. And of course, things never stay simple.
No.
It started as like an assignment for school, and I liked the little story bit that I came up with so much. I'm like, oh man, I have to do more of these characters. But what? Like, I started with the characters and didn't have a story, and that's one of the hardest things to do, because you're like, oh man, I love all these things about these characters, and now I have to try and fit a story around them, and it's really hard.
Because, I don't know, because I think characters should guide the story myself.
Definitely. That's always how I used to do it.
Yeah.
I mean, I never used to work with plot when I wrote things. Mm-hmm. I'm still terrible at plot. I always started with a character, and I'm like, what would this character do in this situation?
Yeah.
So then I would start writing a scene, and as I wrote it, they would come up with things that they would do, because I would get into their headspace and be like, oh, well, of course they'd react this way. Mm-hmm. And then I just keep throwing interesting scenarios at them, but it meant that I never knew what the story was beforehand, which is not very great when you're doing comics, because you kind of need to have a story before you start. Otherwise, if it doesn't work out, mm-hmm. you've got all these pages, and it's just like why you do storyboards before you do an animated film. It's
there's that classic Robert Crumb story that ends at the top of the page, and he says, this is why you plan out your comics, folks. That's the final
really, because like Dan Klaus did that too.
Crumb was there first, I think.
Okay.
Yeah, I think I'm trying to think if there's any one thing that really helped me get through it to just start it, and I think before I did the little story bit that I've done now, I'm working on a 13-page like kind of introduction, like first chapter thing, and I'm on page 12 now, so one more page left, it'll be done soon. Yay! But before I did that, I wrote over 35,000 words before I even figured out what I wanted the story to be about.
Oh, wow.
I don't, like, I came to writing through prose, through, you know, proper, you know, through novels and things and writing my own. So whenever I think about a story, I think about it in that way. So I always sit down and I'll just write, like, paragraphs and paragraphs of stuff. And it's incredibly time-consuming and very demoralizing when you get to, like, you know, hours and hours of writing. And you look back and you're like, oh, no, I don't want it to be like that. I need to write something new. And it's just, then you have to throw all that stuff away. And it's really hard. Writing is incredibly difficult. And I'm still trying to find a way of making it work for me and to kind of be okay with so-called wasting all that time, because it's all worthwhile. It all goes somewhere. But until then, it's like you're sitting alone at a desk and you're writing and you're like, oh man, what if this isn't what I'm like? I'm still like years away from ever getting to drawing these pages. And oh God, you know, it's hard.
So, now, it's funny because the former Ink Panthers, Alex Robinson and Mike Dawson, both write on the drawing boards. They don't pre-plan, they don't write a script or whatever. They just sit down and start to draw and write out their stories, and they'll edit them. At some point, they'll go back and take out pages and redraw things, which seems to me crazy. But obviously, it works for them because it gives them, I guess, a fresh way. They're not getting bogged down in the writing stage. They're just doing what they love, which is drawing.
Well, when you... Sorry, go ahead. I was going to go, like, when you... Because when I write, I usually have a loose plot when I write, but then I will kind of stick figure things out, or, you know, I will draw my story. That's the easiest way for me to do things,
unless
I don't have time, in which case I'll go straight to a script set. That basically feels like how I work anyway. I just wouldn't probably do full inks and the whole thing as I went along. But I can do that. I find it easier sometimes, instead of hand writing the story or typing the story, to draw the story in terms of figures. You just get a different vibe in your head. It tricks your brain into going into a different place.
Yeah.
And you do it. When you write, do you write like a script, or do you doodle ideas down?
Well, I've been writing a lot recently, and I'm really loving the writing process. It was really refreshing because I was totally blocked for years after Y and Doctor Who's kind of like, I can't more. And so I just started writing, and I've just been writing crazy. I really love it. But when I'm coming up with a plot, usually what I'll do is I'll write down the bullets of all the plots, and I'll start at the first bullet and then write like basically create space after that bullet and write it until I get to the next bullet and erase the first. And then by the end, it's script.
Mm-hmm.
Or sometimes I'll, like, if I'm planning out pages, I'll draw out like 22 boxes and figure out where's the middle of all this. I'll go to, you know, there's 11. What should be happened by 11? And then you can kind of fill in the boxes. Okay, this was supposed to happen here, this scene here, this scene in this box. And before I know that, there's a whole script. And it keeps you from going overboard and like, oh, I have 25 pages, I should have 4, that kind of
thing. Yeah.
Do you find your characters when you're, like, if you draw a character, do you find the character through that, or does it develop in your head, like when you're coming up with, like, characters in your stories? Like, do you doodle up, like, say, your lead character?
Oh, yeah.
Side characters?
Well, I think,
you know, with the general idea of what they're behind, and then when you see them, that informs what they are? Or is it all in your head first, and then you're just trying to project that onto the page?
Well, it's been a long time since I did Rounders, and I think Rounders was a case of, that was the best I could draw, you know? So that was the best I could do at that time, and that's what I drew. Just because that's all I could, you know, it was in no way what I wanted it to look like, but it's the best that I could do at that time.
So when you were drawing your character out, was the character the same by the time you'd finished that drawing as it was when you started drawing it? Or did you...
No, actually...
I guess that's my question, is when you see the character, you go, oh, obviously he's this, this, and this from that mustache.
No, I think it kind of comes full-blown, like, before you know... You know, in some ways, your characters are reactions to each other too, though, right? So when you design one character, then your other character has to look different from that character. So if you have one character with light hair, then you need a character with dark hair, because you need to have that differentiation between looks so that the page balances in some way, right? And you kind of unconsciously do that, I think. And then with Rounders, I drew 3 pages and then I threw them away. I didn't actually throw them away, but I stopped using them and started redrawing it because I realized just how terrible I was. No, and that I could do it better. So I figured out a better way, and I just started to redraw it, you know. But it looked a lot... I thought it looked better. I know, you'd look at it and say, yeah, you were right to do that, Dave. You're absolutely right. I just, because I had simplified what I was trying to do, and I, instead of overextending myself, I you know, went backwards a little bit and said, okay, I can do this. This will work for me. This simpler way of drawing will be better. I still, you know, Fantagraphics still didn't like it. They rejected it. But said I was terrible at anatomy.
Well, let's talk about that then, rejection. So you sent something to Fantagraphics?
I did not send something to Fantagraphics. This is a story we've told on the show before, but we went down to Seattle to a book fair, and there was a Fantagraphics table there.
Right.
And the guy had to go to the bathroom, so we took over the table for him while he went to the bathroom.
Okay. Was I one of the guys taking over the table?
Yeah, you were with me.
I can't remember many things in my life.
We went down with Lisa.
Okay.
And then he came back, and so we were talking a little bit, and I just gave him the comic. It's like, well, here, just take, I have a dumb comic I've done. You know, the kind of hard sell I like to do. And the stupid comic, you can take it. And then, so he took it, and I thought that was all right. And then a couple months later, I got a rejection letter from Fantagraphics. I thought, well, I didn't deserve that, but okay.
Maybe that's the best way to get a rejection letter.
Is unintentionally?
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. It's funny.
Did he give a critique or just like a...
Yeah, there was a critique. You know, they liked the story. They didn't think the art was strong enough, which I wouldn't argue with. I think they're right, but no one wants to hear that after they spend 6 months scribbling away on something. And then it's funny. I was just reading, been rereading a lot of Philip K. Dick because someone in our question show asked a question about Man in the High Castle, and that sent me off on this Philip K. Dick reading frenzy. And I'm reading Valis right now, and there's a line in the book where he says, "Everyone in their life receives a lethal blow, and not everyone gets a cure, but everyone in their life will have something happen to them that kind of kills them inside." And I thought that was a really interesting quote. He's talking, obviously, Philip K. Dick is writing about himself in the story, about his own time when he tried to commit suicide and ended up in the mental ward. And but yeah, it's an interesting thing, because when you think about whether you get rejected by Fantagraphics in a letter, which I don't think that was a real ego killer. My ego was already killed like years before that. So that was just nothing. It was just piling on by that point. But in your life, yeah, you know, whether you have dreams that someone decides that they're no good and they're going to trample them for you, or you get a letter like that, something was going to hurt you in a way that makes it hard for you to carry on forward, so, right?
Heather knows the contest.
Okay.
As that we usually have on the show, like, you got to guess what the siren is. So, folks, what did you guess? Heather, what was it?
I think it was a police car.
Nope.
It was an ambulance.
Sorry.
I've got nothing but
trains. 5 points off for Heather. 10 points to Gryffindor.
Well, by the type of siren. A long siren is an ambulance. A short, like a short one. Police
car. Right. And a beautiful song is a siren song, which will lure you sailors to your demise.
And at which case, the ambulance will come to rescue using a siren. It's very confusing for sailors.
Now, okay, so what was your... have you got a rejection story? Anyone else here?
Well, I mean...
I was told I was too much like Alex Robinson, and they already had one of those, so they didn't need me. That was my... I think it was Antarctic Comic rejected me that way.
I think I've just always had the idea that the rejection is really just nailing down what you fix. See, with your case, I'm really pissed for you for that, because you didn't submit to be critiqued. And that's not fair, because that's like you're doing your fun stuff, and you know, and you're finding your way. And there's a point where, as an artist, you decide I'm ready to put it out there and to get critiqued, to get info, so I can get to another level. But if you're fine where you are, it's not right for someone to go, well, I'm gonna bash your dreams now, because that's. But even though he probably wasn't intentional, he's probably really, really positive about it. Maybe he just misconstrued. It's like, oh, he's. This must be a submission for God or whatever.
Yeah.
It's still not cool. Whenever someone shows me art, I always ask, do you want a critique? I'll be happy to look at it, but if you want an actual critique, if you want to help with this, let me know.
Do you want me to Alex Toth this, or do you want to...
Yeah, exactly.
Or do you just want to share it with me?
The Alex Toth one, that's a great example of, like, yes, it's brutal, and it tears apart, but he got better because of that.
Mm-hmm.
And he knew it going in, that that's what he was going in for.
Sure.
And this is what I do now. Clarification on the Alex Toth thing. What does that mean to people who don't know?
Thank you. Well, I'll say Steve Rude, an artist I like a lot, submitted some pages he had done for a Johnny Quest comic to Alex Toth, the great, great comic artist. And Alex Toth basically tore Steve Rude a new bum.
You can find them online. It's impressive.
Yeah. And I mean, if you took away everything Alex Toth says in it and you just read that, it's not that bad.
No.
You know, you'd read it and you'd be like, oh, that's a serviceable story. And Rude had already done, like, hundreds of pages by this point, I'm sure, doing Nexus and stuff like that.
And that's kind of the point in your life. life, in your career where you really want something like that, mm-hmm. because, you know, you're
coasting, maybe. Yeah.
Yeah. You maybe kind of, you've got 100 pages under your belt and you think you're kind of going okay.
Yeah.
And if you're not seeing anything wrong by then, then someone needs to point it out.
Sure.
If you want to get better.
And so, yeah, he gave these pages to Alex Toth to critique for him. And Alex Toth was really, but wasn't, it comes across as cruel or mean, but it's really just straight to the point, you know, and if that's what you want, you know, if you just want a frank assessment of where you are, that is a frank assessment of where Steve Rude was in Alex Toth's opinion. Mm-hmm. And Toth, you know, you could take it or leave it with what he said to him. But, you know, this is a guy with decades of experience of working in all kinds of different types of comics, whether it's romance, horror, superhero, he'd done it all. And yeah. So, you know, he's a person who I don't think I have a book of his comics, and he's not a person who took shortcuts in his art at all. And so it's interesting, though. It's an
and
interesting.
I think also as you get older and more experienced, and you see a lot of the same mistakes being done over and over mm-hmm. again, and you see these guys who have no clue that they're making those mistakes,
yeah.
or they're just so really confident that they're doing just fine.
Yeah.
You get tired of it. You're just mm-hmm. like, okay, sit down, kid. I'm going to talk to you now. And yeah,
something you said like a bazillion times before.
Yeah. I've gotten there too sometimes.
Yeah.
But I still try to be nice. But I will be honest too. I mean, if someone's asking for honesty, I will let them know this needs to be fixed. If mm-hmm. you want to get to where you want to go, you're not going to get there in 6 months if you don't fix it. And otherwise, it's going to take you 5-6 years. Do you want to wait that long? No, I don't. So fix it. So yeah. And I've had my stuff ripped apart. Like, who did Blood?
Yeah.
Oh, I know. DeMuth?
No, not Muth. The other guy.
Yeah, something.
I think he was also on Meltdown. He did the Wolverine bits.
Okay. Mm-hmm. I know the one you mean. He was another one of those watercolor guys.
You tell him the story and I will.
Yeah.
You tell the story.
I showed him my portfolio. I was my first San Diego. I was 19, I think, 18.
Okay.
And I just brought like a little case full of stuff from high school. Okay. And stuff that I'd drawn my own. I want to be a comic book artist. How do I keep my stuff? And he looked
Wait, were you nine, did you say?
No, it felt like it.
She had a lollipop. Kent Williams,
thank you. I was
you were right the first time.
Yeah, and everyone was being very nice because, you know, here's this cute short little mm-hmm. girl who was just out of school and, you know, got Mr. Case and it's all, you know. So anyway, I'm showing his stuff and I'm trying to be nice, so there's lots of feedback. And he ripped into it so hard. Oh my God, he was so angry at some points. He was just like, you can't do this. You can't do this. Oh my God, what are you thinking? And I was just like, and I just walked away stunned, but I wasn't. And then I realized, oh yeah, he's right. This is not professional at all. And then I kind of from there.
Wow.
And there are times like you're gonna get a lot of that. I've shown to so many editors over the years, and you take everything they say, and you don't have to like take it all at face value. But what you do is you pick through to see what's consistent, mm-hmm. like what each one is seeing that's consistent that they're pointing out. That's an obvious flaw. Okay, your perspective is really wrong in this one. And you go back and you do some more stuff, and you show more samples. Oh yeah, perspective is really wrong. So obviously, I got to go find some books on perspective mm-hmm. and fix this.
Yeah.
So there are going to be times where you're going to come across an asshole, and there are going to be times, especially back in the early 90s, almost 85-90% of the editors, the first thing out of their mouth was, wow, you don't draw like a girl. And they thought it was nice. They thought they were being complimentary. And after a while, you get really tired of mm-hmm. it. And so you kind of set that aside. Okay, that's his sexist bullshit. Where do I have to improve now?
Yeah.
What do I need to do to fix this and so I can get a job? And yeah, so you have to kind of have a thick skin, but also just be open to, like, it's going to hurt, but it's gonna be good for you. It's like Buckley's.
Yeah, it's like Buckley's. We always like plugging Buckley's. It tastes awful, and it doesn't.
Works.
No, it doesn't, though. It doesn't work. It's just,
it works for me. It,
where
like
it's
it.
Basically turpentine. It's the same product.
Yeah.
Buy yourself some turpentine. Don't drink turpentine.
What kind of advice is that?
Heather, you're you need Buckley's because you've got a cold right now.
Oh, yeah.
But forget about that. Oh, that's nice. Rejection for her.
I catch everything is what I'm saying.
I'm on the mend.
Okay,
it's okay.
That's fair enough. And speaking about things that are on the mend, your work and a rejection. Has anyone like rejected your stuff?
Oh, gosh. So I don't know if I'm in, well, the same league here.
No.
There's no league.
Than you, Heather.
Yeah.
We're all
exactly,
very,
right?
very good.
Yeah.
Yeah, Heather, come on. You are not in our league. We all understand that, right?
Yeah.
We're much better than Heather, right?
Oh, for sure.
You guys have pity on me right now. That's why you've got me here.
You're
not even going to put the show out. You're just doing it for my benefit.
Yeah,
you're going
right.
to send me, you know.
Right,
yeah.
We're just going to call you kid and tussle your hair.
Yeah.
So tell us the time you were rejected by Ian.
You draw great, by the way. Let's just say that. You draw great.
Yeah.
You know, your stuff is fantastic. Yeah. You've done some drawings for this show that we do, the Critical Hit Show. And when we put the drawings on the big screen, it always gets a gasp. A gasp of like, oh my God, that's amazing. So
thank you so much. Yeah.
Forget all the bullshit I just said, really.
I think my problem was I've always been way too hard on myself. I'm obviously my own worst critic, and because of that, I didn't even want to go and do art when I finished high school. I was just adamant, oh, all I do is draw unicorns and dragons. Nobody wants to see that stuff. That stuff is kids' play, you know. Who gives a crap?
Yeah, Dave.
Yeah, exactly.
No one wants to see the dragon drawing.
I just want
to
say
it's
that...
It's been 251.
I don't want anyone...
Move on, buddy!
I just want to say I don't want anyone critiquing the title cards. I'm perfectly happy with the compliments I'm getting, everyone. Just keep them coming.
See, this is before the resurgence of My Little Pony, right? So I had nowhere to go.
Yeah. But up.
Yeah. So I bummed around in school for a while. I did a lot of general studies, trying everything, like every genre or class under the sun, and I loved all of it, which didn't help. And after a while, I quit school and I worked for a couple of years, and then that made me absolutely miserable because, you know, retail, yay! And finally realized, you know, or I went back to school again, did another couple of semesters of general studies, and was like, you know what, art has always been there, and it's what I spend the majority of my time, you know, engaging with online. It's, you know, I think about it a lot, I talk about it a lot, I should just do that. And so I went to a very technique-focused fine arts diploma program at Langara. So it's completely different from the foundation program at Emily Carr, in that they make you try every single medium that they've got available. So you have to do a bit of design, you have to do painting, you have to do ceramics and sculpture and printmaking and all sorts of things. And it's a 2-year kind of intensive thing. And in your second year, you get to choose 2 classes to focus on. And I chose ceramics and printmaking. So it wasn't even like painting or drawing or anything. And being able to focus on the technique and getting better at something was such a great way to alleviate my anxiety about the fact that, oh, all I do is draw unicorns and dragons. Because, you know, I was doing pots and I was doing, you know, kind of cool technique-based things with printmaking, and I was in love with it. And then... yeah, I went to Emily Carr, and that was a completely different atmosphere. And I went there to finish off my degree and didn't get into the ceramics program, which at the time was a huge, like, oh no, what am I going to do if I can't do ceramics? And I did printmaking for a while and realized in the critiques of printmaking that the fine art world, like the whole thing that Emily Carr builds itself around, was totally not my bag. There were so many things going on in those critique rooms that really made me realize, oh, I cannot do this. This is not who I am. And
it was besides your art that there was a different agenda that was...
Well, there was a subtle thing where anything that had a narrative in it was considered, you know, kind of like, well, why did you do that? You know, I can see a story in this, and that's not good. Or at least it's not necessarily not good, but you have to have a very, very good reason for it. You know, and the vast majority of art that a lot of people are coming up with is very abstract or very, you know... conceptual things that people could put their own ideas into. And the minute you put a story in there, it's like, oh, we can't bring our own ideas to it anymore. Now it's set, you're pretty much an illustrator, and that's not necessarily a good thing. It's like, oh, you're feeding us information instead of letting us come up with our own interpretations of the work. And it was in that class, and I had a very great, fantastic teacher that I can't remember his name, I'm terrible. I told him, you know, I think I'm going to focus on illustration. There was an illustration program, Emily Carr, and so I think I'm going to try and get into that, and I need to switch my focus. And he immediately said, that's great. And then in critique said, okay, everybody, Heather's, you know, focusing on more of an illustration bent, let's critique it that way. And that just totally changed my life. But of course, and I got into my first illustration classes and had panic attacks my first couple of days and nearly dropped out, because I was convinced that everybody else was amazing and fantastic and deserved to be there, and I totally didn't. And it was all thanks to my teacher at the time, my illustration teacher, Caliph Brown, who is an amazing children's book author and poet. He puts out like 1 children's book every year. He's amazing. He does this amazing art, and he makes these fantastic poems. And he was just so supportive, and, you know, still critiqued, you know, really well, and told you where things were bad, but was like, no, you can totally do this. And that just completely changed things. But then again, I was still in a school like Emily Carr. And there's a point in your fourth year where you have to do the fourth year review panels, which which means you have to put your work in front of a bunch of teachers that possibly might not have seen it before, and they come at it at a like multidisciplinary angle. So they look at it from their point of view and give you critiques on your work. And in my fourth year, I had done a studio class where I was focusing on comics. I was like, oh man, I love comics. It was like I was rediscovering my love of comics at the time. And I did these two grad comics that I had done based on dreams I had had. And they weren't like, oh, here's a dream I had and it was so weird, let me do a comic about it. It was, you know, taking threads of story bits from a dream, writing a new story around those bits, and then making comics about them. So they still had an interesting, like, weird background to them, but they were fully fledged stories. And I had to do this review panel, and the whole point of the review panel was you got different ideas and different point of views from your work, and there were a lot of illustration students that were picking review panel groups that had a lot of illustration teachers in them or teachers they had dealt with before, and I was like, you know what, no, I'm going to embrace, you know, the spirit of this.
Uh-oh.
Yeah, and I'm going to find some teachers that have never seen my work before, or, you know, just people from different mediums. And
sure. You said, I can get a whip and hit myself with it.
And it did not go well.
Yeah.
I actually did have an illustration teacher that I had before, a fantastic children's book author, Julie Morstadt, who's won awards. She was nominated for the Governor's General Awards in Canada a couple years ago. She's okay. She's amazing. And there are a couple other people. There's a ceramics teacher and I think a sculpture teacher that I had no idea who that person was. And they did not, you know, like my comics at all.
Wow.
we had 20 minutes in a room with them and they were supposed to look at your work and then just talk about it. And, you know, it's you can talk if you want, but I think the idea is you're supposed to remain quiet and just let them give you their unbiased opinion.
Right.
And they didn't even read the comics. Like one of them was a 4-page comic. The other one was like 7, but they didn't even read them. They just kind of stood back and looked at them, maybe looked up close, maybe once, and then stepped back and were just completely baffled and had no idea and what to do with them.
Yeah.
And I think that was the first time I ever really hit the point where I'm like, wow, you know, there are some people out there who have no idea how to relate to comics.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah.
And it was just, they finally asked like, okay, so what are you trying to do here? And I was like, okay, I'll explain it a bit to them and hopefully they'll understand. So I said, well, you know, I was doing a series of comics based on dreams, and the sculpture teacher was like scribbling furiously in a notebook through all of this. And finally, after everybody else said their piece, which is, you know, a bunch of like critiques on, oh, well, it's not drawn very well, you know, the perspective's off, oh, I don't like the digital coloring, why did you color it digitally, what's the point of that, why didn't you do it traditionally, you know, then this guy had this long list of things, and I can't remember most of them because they're just completely off the walls, like weird critiques about things, but the first thing he said to me was, the minute you told me it was about dreams, I immediately lost interest. Because everybody knows that dreams are boring and nobody wants to hear about your dreams. And so that was really hard. And
wow.
And my last fourth year studio class was, you know, you have 2 4th year studio classes. One is in your medium of choice or your, you know, area of choice. So you're surrounded by people who know what you're doing and know your medium. And then the second fourth year studio class is interdisciplinary. So you're in with a bunch of other students from different areas of the school and possibly other teachers that are from different areas. And I got to that and I did not have any, like there were maybe 2 other illustration students in the whole class and everybody else were like painters and sculptors and all sorts of things. And I was just like, you know, I can't do comics anymore for this class. I can't. How are they going to critique a comic script? You know, how are they going to critique thumbnails? It's like, it's not going to work. And and so that's when I did my Bouguereau Women watercolor paintings, which I'm not sure if you've seen.
I haven't seen them.
They're just, I took paintings from Adolphe Bouguereau, who was a romantic painter from the 1800s. You know, very pastoral, beautiful, like giant, like 6-foot-tall works of art, oil paintings of beautiful women, like very much in the classic, you know, romantic tradition. I gave the beautiful women animal heads, like kind of weird looking animal heads. But then I had to struggle with the whole idea of, well, why are you doing this? What's the purpose behind it? And I couldn't just say, well, I thought it was funny, because that was most of it. But, you know, it was just...
For me,
and it's a good reason, really.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I ended up having, like, over the course of the semester, coming up with all these, like, just trying to find some sort of idea, like, just... it was kind of like bullshitting, you know, just trying to come up with anything that could make it seem legitimate.
Yeah.
Yeah, that always seemed very intimidating to me about school is the artist.
Yeah.
You have to come up with this. All they're interested in is the artist.
Doesn't that seem like they're just trying to train you to bullshit? Yeah. Which isn't a bad thing as an artist to learn.
I guess. To
aim your bullshit at the people who want to buy your work.
Yeah.
That's a good thing for a professional artist to learn. Okay. But it seriously does feel like.
Yeah. Because a lot of times when if I'm doing stuff that's not comics, I'm just doing it because it's weird in my head.
Yeah.
I don't really have any mind as far as what am I trying to get across. No, I see this thing. I'm doing it. This is what it is.
Yeah.
Yeah, there it is.
Well, it sounds really demoralizing to me. Like,
oh, it was.
So much stuff around what you really want to do. Yeah. It just feels like, you know, you're having to like, you know, break through walls and smash down doors just to, you know, do what you wanted, this very simple thing that you wanted to do.
There were so many people that were so good at it and embraced it. And I had done, at that point, like that was my fifth year of studying art. And, you know, I'd done art history, I'd done, you know, critical theory classes, I've done all these things. And it bothered me so much that I couldn't seem to relate to, like, say, the abstract art that we were critiquing the same way as everybody else. Mm-hmm. Or I couldn't seem to engage with that whole idea of art theory, of concept, of, you know, that whole idea of writing about your work and that being all, like, just as important as the work itself. I just couldn't figure that out. And that was always like, what am I doing wrong? Like, it felt like a problem for me. It was like, oh, if I just study it, I'll figure it out. And it didn't happen.
Yeah.
And
I think it reflects what you like about art, which is you like it to look like something. And so when you see a modern art, I relate to it as like graphics to me. It's just a design. And so I either like the design or I don't like the design. So when you look at Miro, either like the designs of circles and squares and lines with a triangle at the end of it, or you don't. That's, you know, you have a simple choice there. Either you like...
Reminds me of the PlayStation. That's either a circle, it's a square, it's a triangle, it's an X. Okay, yeah.
Either it appeals to you aesthetically or it doesn't. And I don't think any amount of subtextualizing is going to make you like it more or less, you know.
There was a really great book that I just recently read, and it was published in the like late 1970s. So it was about, it was called The Painted Word by Tom Wolfe.
Yeah, that's a very good book.
Yeah, and there's at the end of the introduction, it completely hooked me when he said, like, I can't remember the words exactly, but that instead of the art existing as itself and the theory helping to describe the art only existed to illustrate theory. That the art wasn't necessarily the most important thing. The most important thing was the theory, and then the art existed specifically to give credence to the theory. And that completely changed my outlook. Like, oh yes, that's exactly my experience.
Yeah.
And it's not necessarily that other people, like what other people are doing is just bullshit. It's not. They, you know, everybody has their own reasons for doing art, and they're all fantastic reasons. And it was just that critique of, you know, the abstract expressionists of that entire...
There is a certain bourgeois element to that Wolf book that's a little barbaric, but it's still an interesting critique of I think he did one about architecture as well, unless that's in the Painted Word as well.
It was just that was
some of Bauhaus, and
it was definitely a harsh critique and was very tongue-in-cheek, but it was very cathartic for me to read. It was, art school is a fantastic place, and I met so many amazing people and you know, like students and classmates, and my teachers were all fantastic. But I did have somebody come up to me asking me if I would recommend Emily Carr for illustration, and I don't think I would. It's not like for a certain type of illustration, certainly, but for there's a lot of politics and stuff in there too, because the illustration program when I went was only 3 years old, and the school was trying to mold it into what it wanted to be instead of, you know, what illustration students might have needed. It's a hard question, and I don't think there's another illustration degree program offered in Vancouver that, you know, that you can get that isn't at Emily Carr. There used to be one at Capilano, and I don't know if there still is, but it was, you know, you don't really have a lot of options, but
when you're saying the critiques you got there, it's just, I wanted to grab a bag of slaps and just send it into, and that just is so infuriating to me hearing that. And I understand it's like that kind of world, and that's the critique you get in that kind of world, but it feels, you know, the person who's saying anything from Fantagraphics, it's like someone who stops an artist or just breaks an artist, it just feels like such a sin.
Yeah,
it just feels like such a sin.
I was already broken, though, so there's, I don't think that did very much to me in terms of my own.
But they did the same thing to Ed Brubaker, mm-hmm. I remember as well. You know, because he wanted to be an artist in the mode of the Love and Rocks folks and Chester Brown, and was influenced by those. And they just kept coming at him hard, but just like, you're too much like Chester Brown. Okay, I'm going to send in the other thing. Oh, well, this is way too Love and Rockets. What are you ripping off Love and Rockets? And they would just be so harsh with the guy that I think it did break his drawing spirit. And he ended up, you know, going successfully, of course, into writing. But still, fuck you. Fuck you. That's why I really like, you know, the webcomic scene now of just like where you can skip over that to a degree, put your stuff out there, then actually put it right to the people.
I would love to talk about webcomics.
Well, unfortunately, we don't have time. So, thanks for being on the show.
We're too old to know what you're talking about.
Everybody, XTC.
We're too old to know what you're talking about.
No, I definitely think that my, you know, I've been graduated from, like, I got my degree a year and a half ago, and this entire last year and a half has been me trying to figure out my art, you know, outside of that kind of idea of what other people thought that art should be. And just
all that bullshit.
It's hard.
It is hard because, you know, you can't help but take authority and put it in your head.
Yeah.
Because we're taught as children to take authority and put it in our head. When authority tells us things that we're bad, then we put "we're bad" into our head. And now you've got to work.
You keep it up, and that's, you then become the prison guard.
You become the prison guard. That's the lethal blow. And it's hard for people to work out of that feeling about themselves, you know, whether it's well-meaning or institutional or, you know, whatever, or mistaken in my case, where I got a, you know, some sort of clerical error. I don't know exactly what I got rejection letter.
Betty Crocker saying this isn't a recipe. That's right. And here's what we think of it.
Boom. Rejection letter 1008-A. But I feel like it's, you know, those are sort of things that, you know, either you have that tough carapace to make, you know, carry yourself on and just shrug all that off, or you're me and you just collapse because your shell isn't strong enough.
Or you're the soft little chick inside that fucking egg.
Yeah.
And occasionally the egg cracks and the chick gets hurt, and then occasionally the egg shields it. I do want to get into the webcomic thing, but it's something I also wanted to talk about just because I happen to know Pia in many ways. You're about as established a comic book artist as you could get, and I'm going to brag and say there's some awards behind me that you've won, and you might just go, she's got it going on, man. That's it. Now it's time to hit cruise control and just ride this fucker out.
Yeah.
But you're kind of starting off right now in kind of your scene, and you've had the first arc of your scene and been and had, you know, praise for it and what have you. But you're now trying new stuff too, and I just want to get into a little something about your journey, and also that the journey doesn't end point. There's never a point where you just go, here we go.
Well, no, because like
Tell her that.
There was just a point where it's like you do 7 years of Y, and that was a really specific type of thing. It wasn't I really expect to be doing. I always figured I'll be a working artist, that's fine. I didn't expect to be out a book that would do so well, and that was like shit. And there's a lot of expectation now on you. So, and when I jumped onto Doctor Who, and there was a lot of that pressure, and it's like I really should have just waited a little bit longer before doing that. And that kind of broke me. That was just because there was a lot of personal stuff going on. A friend had cancer, and it just hit all at once, just as I was getting the steam, you know, good head of steam going, because it was a bit of a false start because I had the flu, and I was like, okay, now I'm already behind, and I don't like this feeling, because I went through a lot of this with Y. Almost all of it was I was a week or two behind, sometimes more, and it was just trying always that feeling, always catching up, feeling awful.
There was a week you went blind.
There was a week I went blind. Oh, and
was that totally stress related?
No, that was I caught KC. It's just like really extreme pink eye. I think from a bird.
The cat
killed a bird, and I was trying to grab it and take care of it, and it died in my hands, and I was crying, and there's feathers everywhere, and I think it got in my eye.
Ugh.
And so a few days later, we were at dinner at Ian's birthday, and we're having this big fancy dinner, and my eyes started itching, and I thought, I must be reacting to this crazy food, because we had a chef special.
Okay.
And it was nuts. It was like every little animal in the forest. It
felt
was French.
Really bad.
I felt really bad by the end of it. It's like, this is just nature getting back at me for eating little squabs and little squirrels and whatever all this little tiny animals are. It was rabbit, it was venison, it was squab.
It felt terrible.
It was awful, but it was really tasty. But it was
that's
like,
the last time you go to that hillbilly restaurant.
It was Feeny's. Yeah, they're gone.
It was totally
supposed to be special. We did a chef special. And Lumiere, that's right. Sorry.
Oh, yeah.
And I thought, okay, I'm allergic to something. We went to the hospital. I thought, oh, you got a little bit of pink eye. I was like, oh, that's awful. I haven't had that since school. They gave me some drops, and the drops didn't help.
Mm-hmm.
2 days later, I'm in agony, and and it's just, it's really bad. Like, yeah. My whole eye is red, and it's just, and it's just keeps seeping the stuff that dries to the inside of my eyelids and scratches my corneas. And so it's a big, long process of basically debriding your eyelids every few hours so you can get some sleep.
Mm.
Because as soon as you start moving your eyes, it scratches. And so, yeah, after 2 or 3 days, went to the hospital, and my doctor, who sent me to a specialist like an hour later, which if you're in Canada, you know that's a bad sign.
Yeah, that's a very bad sign.
Any specialist takes like a month or a few to see.
And when they bring every intern in.
Yeah, and all the interns came in, and they're all whispering. Yep. I'm like, oh, shit, I'm going to go blind.
Keeping their distance.
And,
Kleenex box is now yours forever.
So they had like the first round of interns, and then they left. And then another round of interns, and all this whispering. I'm like, this is bad.
Been there, too.
Yeah, and so he sat down, like, okay, you have AKC. And he writes down a thing on a script, and I think, oh, thank God, there's some medication for this because I'm in so much pain. He's like, well, sadly, can't give you anything for this. It's just going to have to run its course. And on the paper, it said 10% bleach. You're going to have to make a 10% bleach solution, bleach everything in your house, and you're in quarantine for the next 10 days.
Holy crap.
And it was bad. So basically, I just spent the next 4 or 5 days in bed with compresses in agony. I couldn't see because my muscles had gotten so weak from dealing with this that I just blurred. It was just everything, even on the good eye. So yeah, I was trying to, I was on the phone with editors like, I can't see. I'm so sorry.
Tomorrow then? Can you get it done?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Sure, they were sympathetic.
So yeah, there's
moral of the story, fuck birds.
It was stressful. It was, and you know, you're doing a lot of the same thing, and then you kind of get to, you're finally done, and everything's open and done, and you're like, I just want to not do this for.
Yeah.
And so I took a couple of years off, and then I thought, well, I maybe have a few ideas.
Which you should have done right after Y finished. You would agree with that, right? You probably shouldn't have gone into that Doctor Who,
because
you needed to decompress after you spent like, you spent 7 years underwater, living in a bathysphere, and you needed to decompress.
In this very room that we're in right now.
Yeah. And you needed to decompress after that.
And it was just and it was a lot of miscommunication with editors on the Doctor Who gigs, which turned into a just nasty. And so I just said, fuck all this. I'm gonna take some time off. I'm not gonna think about comics. I'll come back to it when I'm ready.
Yeah.
And then over a few years, it's like, am I gonna be ready again? I've been trying. I have ideas. I was writing a lot of stuff, but then it came down to time to draw it out. Like, nope, not coming out.
Yeah.
And so now I'm just doing short stories. I'm doing like fill-ins. And mostly what really helped was doing stuff for friends. Like with Morita.
Yeah.
He would,
drawing horses.
He hurt his hand one time, and it's like, okay, I'll do some on this, or another time. And he knew someone like, oh yeah, this guy is late on a deadline. Come on over. And we're all sitting around helping this guy finish his deadline. Then we just got a call. It's like, well, I'm off this, but they need someone for a fill-in for a couple of issues. Do you come in? It's like, yeah, sure. I'll do that. It's like, I'm doing it for somebody else.
Yeah.
And it feels like I'm being helpful.
Mm-hmm.
And, it's
not as much pressure.
Yeah. It's like a script doctor-y kind of thing. It's like, you're coming in, taking over, so doing that, the hard, like, he's done all the heavy lifting. I'm just kind of filling him up, spelling him out.
Yeah.
And that feels good. And I'm finally getting to a place where I'm getting him back in a rhythm. The Black Canary thing was just like, okay, I think I could do a couple of issues on this.
Yeah.
Even then, it kind of
that was a little behind. That was a little bit of an ordeal as well, though.
A little bit, but not. It was more because the script was really late,
mm-hmm.
so it was already starting on a crunch.
Yeah.
And I hate that feeling. I thought when I was signed up, I'd be like, oh, I got a month and a half lead in, which is awesome.
Yeah.
Lots of time, I can totally focus. And it's like, no, your lead's gone. You gotta really bear down because it's like, I can't do this. And so, but I did it. And I think in the end, the second issue, they had someone come in the end because that lead in got so badly taken out, they had to bring another artist while I was finishing up.
Yeah.
That happens, and it's, you know.
Sure, it happens. Like, it's weird that there's no, that's the lead time that, you know, why not 3 months? Why not 3 months, guys?
I know. And that's the industry now. There's just, because a book can get canceled after 2 issues.
Yeah.
Even one issue, they can go, we're not going to do anymore. So they're not going to put you on an issue, on a series for 6 issues, only to find out you're going to get canceled after one. That's a lot of a lost investment. They want people who can churn out.
Yeah.
And that's fine, I accept that, but now it's more like, I'm going to do very small amounts of work with these guys. I'm going to keep focusing, coming back to finishing my projects. I've written a lot of stuff, and I want to draw them out, and it's just it's like, the thing is, you want to try something different, because you don't want to keep doing the same thing over again, and you want to try different genres, and then you
The Last Woman.
No. This is one. There's a sci-fi story. There's a superhero kind of fun story. There's a few other things, and it's like, well, what style would suit this? Because I'm not going to do the Y style. This doesn't work.
Yeah.
So it's like you're playing around with your drawing. You're trying to figure out, and then sometimes what happens is you go back to your old style, and then it gets really frustrating. It's like, I don't want this. I want something else. I'm looking.
But isn't that you? Isn't the style kind of reflect you as an artist though at the same time?
Yeah, but it's hard to kind of change your style. Sure. You really want to because you want to branch out and try something new, and it's hard not to fall back on old habits. Mm-hmm. So that's the thing that can be a real struggle sometimes, because you want to innovate and your hand is kind of used to doing this one thing.
I think that's why Mobius drew with a pencil when he drew his Mobius, as rather when he drew his Jean Giraud when he was doing like Lieutenant Blueberry.
Yeah.
He would draw ink, you know, pen and ink with a lot of lines and stuff like that.
Yeah, but then
when he did
tools.
When he did Airtight Garage of Jerry Cornelius, almost all of it looked, to me, it looks like he did with pencil.
Yeah, and I've been doing that too, because I think that's another part of the last couple of years, what I've been experimenting with, is how to hybridize. You know, like, I did everything on pencil and board before, and I very rarely did my own ink, because I'm shit fixing inks. I have no patience. I try to wipe things out, and I go back to it before it dries and makes a mess. So I'm awful at it. And then I tried doing it into Photoshop. It's like, then I'm like, this takes twice as long, you know, doing this. So,
same thing. There's nodding of agreement.
Yes. Photoshop takes twice as long?
I still don't ink
in Photoshop. I still ink on I still pencil and ink.
That's impressive. Yeah, your stuff is really clean for that. I mean, mine is, I'm still a penciler, so I erase half the shit I'm drawing. And so you can't apply that to inking, you have to slow down.
What I do now is I do my roughs in Manga Studio. And then when I have my base purple and green lines and stuff like that all kind of figured out, then I'll print that up and then I'll pencil off of that. And then pencil onto tracing paper, and then I'll ink onto
it. There's all kinds of ways to do it. I mean, when I jumped on Torchwood after my initial break, a short story for that, and so I thought, okay, I'm gonna draw it out on the computer and then print it blue line.
Yeah, it's a very hard process, though.
Yeah, and I tried that. I thought, oh, this might work because everything is laid out. Mm-hmm. And but the problem was my printer didn't do a true blue line.
Mm-hmm.
It couldn't get rid of those of the underlines beneath, and that was like I had to redo whole pages because it couldn't get rid of those.
You couldn't get rid of those colors.
Yeah.
You couldn't do like a.
It turned into gray. So what happened is it became a gray, like a pencil line, and you couldn't just wipe it out.
Weird.
Back then, the technology wasn't really there.
Yeah. So but you think you could select. Right, you can do a select. You can select that color and then try and get rid of it, but it's so hard. It's so hard.
Now, what? So, what do you draw on now?
So, that's gradually kind of went. Then I just.
We are
so that's your block.
Scripts.
This is you're kind of basically describing your block, really.
I got onto the Cintiq and was like, oh, maybe I can do the whole thing in Cintiq. Like, mm-hmm. That's a lot of work. It's a little hard because my hand wasn't used to it yet.
Mm-hmm.
It's hard.
Yeah.
So I started doing that, and that's good. And now I'm trapped in my basement drawing on Cintiq all the time, and it's kind of lonely down here. So, but then this thing.
Spiders are there to keep you comfortable.
Spiders like to drop down from the ceiling right in front of me, which is great when you're farsighted. You're not sure what this funny thing is in front of you.
Hey, you're drawing.
Yeah.
It's drawing, big
so
black thing.
Yeah, so you keep a ruler nearby just for specifically to take the spiders out.
You mean to let me just specify, because there are angry...
No,
people
I
there.
The,
you use the, you just you push them
aside.
Aside. You're not slapping them with this with the
That's gross.
I'm on your side.
So then this wonderful new thing came out last year, which saves everything. It's beautiful. It's the iPad Pro.
Okay.
And at first I thought, I don't know if I can do anything professionally, but now I've gotten to the point with Procreate.
Mm-hmm.
I just did a cover
for
Marvel. I don't think anyone knows who's in Procreate. I'm doing a DC book right now, all in Procreate,
wow.
And it's pretty awesome. And I can sit on the couch.
Headline.
I can have the news.
Pia Guerra
on,
believes in procreation.
And I can watch movies and be with my cats and not in the basement. And I use this Cintiq for tricky stuff. But right now, I'm just doing it to see if I can do it in iPad. And
that's
awesome.
You know, any way you can trick yourself into doing what you want to do. It's weird that we have to trick ourselves into doing something that we, through our whole lives, have drawn.
Because you've got that critic we brought up in our head.
Yeah, that's right.
That jerk.
Yeah, so it's like,
you don't know we're drawing.
It's becoming more about, ooh, can I solve this puzzle rather than, can I overcome this block inside of me?
Yeah.
Like, no, it's a puzzle now. It's like, ooh, can I make technology work? And I like it, and I'm really digging it.
So what are you drawing on?
Yes.
Yeah, what are you doing, Heather?
I
you just put up a new page
of
Sable and Aster.
Tell us what you're drawing on.
I draw on a third rate kind of drawing tablet or
third rate
tablet monitor. Well, no,
that's the brand. It's not a very good brand name.
It's called a Yanova MSP 19U Plus.
Wow.
Sounds good.
Rolls off the tongue.
Sounds really.
Yeah, it's a tablet monitor, so it works like a Cintiq, but it's not a Cintiq. It's just glass. It doesn't have
Is this the Russian one?
No.
No. Okay, I've heard of something.
Is this the one that killed all those kids?
No. I'm pretty sure it's Japanese.
Okay.
Okay.
Yeah, and it was like.
So everything you do gets really big eyes.
Yeah.
I don't know what happens.
I didn't draw those speed lines.
It's just a fraction of the cost of a Cintiq, yeah. And even the entry level Cintiqs, which are, you know, kind of terrible. So it
what?
Was...
You mean in terms of price or?
It's $2,000 for a Cintiq 21 UX. That's like from a few.
Yeah,
years ago.
I bought the 13 HD or whatever it is.
Yeah. This, yeah.
Which immediately became redundant after I bought it. But
yeah.
It seems kind of small. Is it small to work in?
No, because I mean. You only work in a small area when you're drawing, so not like you. I don't look at all 21 inches of the page when I'm drawing. I sit with my terrible eyesight and pore over a very small portion of the paper. So you know, as long as you can use your little hand, you know, the little hand and move your paper around, I don't find it that awkward really. In fact, I don't know. I mean, I got it just to do color. That was my original idea. I thought, well, this will make it so easy because instead of drawing on a tablet and looking at my screen and magically making my hand move opposite of what my brain is seeing or with my brain, I got very good at it.
I used an Intuos 2 12x12 drawing.
See, that's good. I used a Wacom Bamboo for like 150 title cards. So.
The Intuos 2 12x12 was a square like shaped tablet. It wasn't like formatted to be the shape of a screen. So
okay.
You had to actually like go into the settings and dictate a portion of the screen to draw on or the tablet to draw on, so it matches the ratio of the screen.
Yeah.
And because otherwise, if you drew a circle, it would come out as like an oval, which is funny because they came with little things like a film over the drawing surface you could lift up and put paper under there that you could trace on. But online it was useless because of this. But that thing was huge. Like the drawing area was 12x12, so it was larger than 12x12. And I drew on that thing for like 12 years.
Yeah.
Before I moved over to my tablet monitor.
Do you do any work on paper?
I did a lot of work on paper in university.
So no. Anyway.
It's just been something I've kind of regrettably fallen out of.
Mm-hmm.
It's just been easier when I'm like penciling things to be able to like make things larger or move things around if I need to, rather than erasing and drawing again. And I do really want to get back into doing more traditional stuff.
Well, that's funny because that's the part I look forward to the most is inking. Like that's basically why I'm drawing. So I can get that brushed out and start
really
doing
miss,
that.
Yeah, inking. I did all of my grad comics with a Pentel pocket brush pen and I loved it. But yeah nowadays.
I don't even use a good brush. It's a fine brush, but I don't think they make it anymore. So I don't know what I'm going to do now, but it's not carried at Opus anymore. I don't know what's going to happen.
The only pencil or paper you can do now is commission cons.
Yeah.
So I'm getting better at that. So I still don't want to do a whole page in that style.
Yeah.
Or like just in that.
So how did you get into the webcomic
sort of thing? Oh, gosh. Well, let me just say before that.
When we're past an hour in the show, I always get to the point.
No, that's great. I'm also a big Manga Studio fan. So I ever since I got that, I pretty much weaned myself off of Photoshop entirely and do nothing but Manga Studio.
Do you color in it as well?
Oh, yeah.
It
took me a long
time. I know so much about Photoshop for coloring that I just feel like, what's the point of relearning all these
I was drawing in Manga Studio for like
myself.
A year before I started to feel in any way comfortable doing color in it. Yeah. I'm not sure what it was, but it's different. And the brushes are different. They work differently. And yeah, color definitely was a bit of a weird jump. But right, we were going to talk about webcomics.
Yes.
Here we go. This is the big end to the show is we're talking webcomics.
Oh, what a finish. And I'm glad you settled on that as a big finish.
This is where the little spider comes down and goes, webcomics? Yeah. I love the web, I'm a spider.
Well, webcomics were just completely like... just revolutionary for me. When I first started getting into the like internet properly, when I was, you know, around like 13 or 14.
Making us feel old.
Yeah. This was like early 2000s. And at that point, that was like, you know, Penny Arcade had just been around for a couple of years. The first comic.
We were over the Y2K scare, so we could actually draw on a computer now and not be able to erase it.
Yeah. So when I first discovered webcomics, it was a revelation because I never grew up with floppy comics. comics, like superhero comics or anything. Never read any of those. Didn't have any comic shops around. It was never anything I did. All I had was pretty much the Sunday Funnies and Garfield omnibuses, which I spent all my money on at Scholastic Book Fairs, were the Garfield books. So having my mind open by webcomics, because there were so many out there and you could read them free, and for, you know, a young teenager, that was like just the best thing ever, that I could find comics and read them, and they weren't just stupid like gag a week, you know, stories about a fat cat who likes lasagna, but no, it could be about anything, and it just completely blew my mind. And I still have never, like, I've never really read any superhero comics, and I feel like maybe I should at some point. But yeah,
I don't know, if you don't know the language of it, though, it's
we'll hook you up. Okay.
Well, it's just like the barrier to entry is so high on so many of these. It's like, oh, well, I'll just go find a number one, but which number one? Because there are like a dozen different number ones. Yep.
That's hard. And then the fact that you're reading a story, even if it's meant seriously. And they'd be like, oh, this is such a serious story. It's all about da-da-da-da. Then you look at it and you go, well, the guy's wearing pajamas. And that's a real – it's hard to appreciate whatever you're telling me when the guy's wearing pajamas. I don't know.
Well, the Beatles look funny too. Anyway, back to you.
did they?
Yeah.
Well, one of,
yes, they did.
One of the first Beetle comics boots. That really blew my mind was a comic called Unicorn Jelly. I don't know if you've heard of this comic.
No.
I'm not quite sure blew if it's aged as well, but this was this amazing giant, like – a huge world that this person created in this webcomic that started with like a little tiny, like it just started with a, like this idea of a witch that lived in a little hut, and she had a little slime friend, familiar, called Unicorn, or his name is Uni because he had a horn and a little tail, so he thought he was a unicorn, but he was just a little slime.
Aww.
And it was done by this woman named Jennifer Diane Reitz, and she had this huge website that was filled after a while after she kept doing it with lore, with backstory, with all this stuff. And it was like this weird world that was made in like this fractal sense where everybody lived on these triangular, like flat worlds. And after a while, the worlds would be absorbed by like crystal, or they would be destroyed in some way, and then they'd have to find a way to move to a new triangular world. And it was just this, and it was like magic and alchemy and machines and everything, and the dichotomy between the two. But not only that, but it seemed really cute because she drew in this kind of like really simple manga style, and she used an old like very early Mac comic program, and she drew it entirely with a mouse. It was just like,
wow.
How she did it, I have no idea. But it just went into this massive world and got really dark and scary, and like characters were dying, and there was horrible backstories and like people getting hurt, and there's all this. But not only that, but it was the first comic I ever read that featured LGBT characters, including a lot of trans characters and even poly relationships. And it was just like, for like a 13-year-old who was reading that stuff for the first time, it just blew my mind. And I was like, holy crap, this is what comics can be. This is what webcomics can be. And it was just all out there for free. It's still up there. You can go to unicornjelly.com and read it. And it's just, that just completely changed everything. And just, you know, up until that point, I was drawing like Garfield ripoff comics. And, you know, and after that, I started thinking, oh man, I would love to do a webcomic someday, but, you know, never really got around to it. But it was always like my dream. And now I'm doing like the Critical Hit Show comic and Sable and Aster. And it's just, wow. Amazing.
What was your first one? That was Sable and Aster your first?
Sable and Aster is my first. I did do a few like small, like weird autobio comics. I only did about 10 of them. And even though they're up,
that's
there
still a lot. 10's a lot.
They never really went anywhere. Sable and Aster is the first thing that I've ever put out there. But, you know, I've been reading webcomics online for, you know, 14, 15 years.
Yeah.
And it amazes me how many people don't know that they exist.
Absolutely.
And there's so many people that are like, oh, webcomics. Oh, that sounds interesting. What would you recommend? And I'm like, oh God, where do I start?
And what store do I buy these at? They're online.
And I've even
heard... Send me a link to where I can find a store that I can buy these at.
And that's the problem with webcomics, is that there isn't like a list, like a definitive list of, oh, here's where you can start. Like, there's no, like, you know, list of web comics. There's nowhere.
There's sometimes people will do like the 10 best, but even that, it's very tricky.
Yeah,
and it's personal taste too. There's a lot of different ones out there.
Yeah, there's not a really good sorting system for that. That's absolutely true. I always go with like a Kate Beaton to start off.
Oh yeah,
you know, and
that's definitely one of my first.
And also, she covers so many topics that, like, if you like superheroes, here's her on Wonder Woman. Super. If you like history, here's her on that. Is that how about autobiography? Here's her with her parents. She's on vacation. She draws long strips about being on vacation. She's just brilliant. And as we've said before in the show, we went to Thought Balloon, or what was it?
Thought Bubble.
Yeah, we went to the big con, was in Leeds.
Yeah.
And she was by far like the biggest lineup.
Oh yeah, Kate.
Amazing, you know, comic book people from all over the world. But boy, howdy, she was just the star of that thing.
Yeah, she is just like this fantastic formula. I mean, it's not just like good drawings and funny humor. It's what the humor is about. It was like, you know, Canadian history or American history, or, you know, just, or like making fun of classic books, or, you know, like the things that she'd always find an audience, and the audience would come from these weird places, but would completely latch onto her work because there was just no other work like it.
Yeah.
And I think that's important.
And it was stuff that she really cared about. Who's the woman who did, who's the designer of BoJack Horseman?
Lisa Hanawalt?
Lisa Hanawalt.
Yeah. You know, her web stuff, again, was something that I do point people to. Mm-hmm. Oh, wait, here we go.
Say police car.
You gotta say police car? Well,
it's a fire truck.
Sorry, that was a fire truck. We watch Emergency every night. How could you possibly get there wrong?
Yeah. Round part 12.
To her review of War Horse or something like that as something that's very unique. Because what you want when you're pointing someone to a webcomic is something that's different, but there's an access point. And people go, oh, shit, that's... And also, it helps if it's funny. Mm-hmm. And both of those are incredibly funny.
Yeah.
Something like a Penny Arcade, you might go, hey, this has been very successful for a long time. There's all these cons. You try and get into it, Jack. Good luck, newcomer. Not welcome. Get away.
I keep being so obsessed too.
And she makes it look like, you know, her art has this like air of easiness of just like dashing it off to it. That is, you know, I think it's very accessible in that way. Like, people can look at it and be like, oh yeah, this is totally like someone I could know, or I could.
It reminds me of when you're in a class, friend, goofing on history, and go like, here's Napoleon doing this thing, and everyone goes, ah.
Yeah.
It's exactly that, and that's why it feels so personable, and really, like, this, like, you're into that space.
Yeah, I've been really liking the stuff that's been on Panel Syndicate, which is Brian K. Vaughan's, you know, he's the guy who worked with Pia on Why, and he's got his own web, you know, comic where you download, you know, comics on there. And I've seen a lot of people try that before. You know, there's things like Thrillbent that Mark Waid does and other things, and they're fine. Everything's fine. But this is the first one that I've gone, oh yeah, this is so good, and the stories are just so top-notch that, you know, you can direct people there, and they instantly get it, and, you know, it does get published in books later, but it's just, it's so, so nice. Ah, man, good stuff on there. Yeah, there's one story, and I forget what the name of it is. Do you remember the first one that was there? It's the one about the world where everyone's got a secret identity, so everyone wears a mask.
Private Eye,
that's right. And
I'm still reading them.
I will not give you any spoilers
slow,
then.
Very slow.
Yeah, but it's just beautifully, beautifully done. It looks so great on a computer, because it was done on a computer.
Okay.
You know?
Yeah.
And that's, I think, the other thing that's kind of interesting is you're actually doing the medium on the medium that you're going to be looking the medium on.
He draws it out. I've seen pages.
Does he draw it out like on the computer?
He does it out on graph paper.
Remember, oh Jesus! Then he does it that way. Oh, I'm sorry. Well, then I'm incorrect.
I think it was in Portugal. They had that con there, and
oh, he did have the art there. Yeah. That's correct. Yeah,
so he does it on paper, but then he scans it.
Okay, well, that's something though.
I think
then
he colors it on.
Then let me change my point to what you're doing now, which is you're drawing a comic on the same screen that I would then read a comic on when it comes out. And I think that's a really interesting thing. Mm-hmm. Like there's no translation issues. It's like, this is what it looks like, and this is the colors I'm using, and when it comes out, this is what it's going to look like. And I think that's a pretty neat different change.
It is interesting. I was just thinking what you guys were talking about to that Japanese show Manben, where it seems that no matter the age of the artist that they've had on there, they almost all still draw ink, you know, pencil to paper, and they do some stuff on their computer, some, you know, but a lot of stuff is just done.
I would say probably in Japan, the reason for that is because they've actually got an industry that works, right? Yeah. So there's no real reason to change. Whereas in North America, our industry is changing so radically that you've got to find different ways to succeed at it. So you innovate.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I'm not even sure if I'm going to be doing like always on a computer either.
Yeah.
It's especially when you read about, you know.
You like your loom. You think you're doing some loom comics.
What?
Giant loom.
I think you're thinking of my my mom.
Oh, that's right. Sorry.
My mom wants a giant loom, so I'm trying to find a way to buy her one.
She liked that. I'm trying to now remember what that movie was with the loom of destiny. That,
oh,
like,
that's Wanted.
Wanted, yeah, that's right. Loom of Destiny.
No.
We'll get your mom a loom of destiny at some point.
Flotsam Jetson? Is that part of a loom, is it? No, I'm wrong.
Anyway. It's a shipping accident.
Is that what it is? Okay. I know there's a woof.
And a woof is on fire.
A woof and a weft?
A woof and some am.
Guys, we're getting near the end of the show. Yeah, we got to point
that down. But there was a warning a couple of weeks ago from Cintiq, from Wacom, basically saying, oh, you know, you should only be doing this for 4 hours at a time. And I think it's
what?
All these animators are like, you're kidding, right? Because there's some hints going on that people are having retinal detachment, staring at the screen for a long time.
Okay.
And I've been working on the iPad like for the last 2 weeks, and my eyes are getting really sore, and I'm like, oh, no. So, like, is this a thing now that we're going to because it's new, it's all new, and no one really knows what the long-term effects are going to be.
Yeah,
and yeah, maybe we're all going to be going back to paper soon at this rate. But, yeah,
it's interesting. Yeah, because coloring, I mean, that's a long process where you spend a lot of time just staring.
Every animator in town does like 15-hour days. Mm-hmm. So it's
At least I break up the art part of it with you know, I just like to do the roughs. I find it very. I don't really like. I don't know. I can't get like the smooth, detailed hand, like work that I, on the computer that I can just sitting down with a pencil on paper, and my hand knows what to do then.
Well, this is the thing. What I really like about the iPad is that they have the Procreate has these amazing pencil brushes. Feel like pencil. Mm-hmm. Even the Cintiq or the Photoshop, I haven't been able to find.
Well, Manga, it does to me. It feels like when you draw with a pencil crayon in Manga Studio. To me, it feels like you're drawing with a pen. At least it looks like a pencil crayon.
Manga Studio's got some really good brushes as well, but I'm just so impressed with Procreate's pencil.
Yeah,
and it just feels like drawing with a pencil. It has the same texture. You can do blurry. You can do like put it on the side and do, you know, big fills that look like a pencil. And so I do like all my
good
layouts.
Good Lord, it's
really
a it's all sirens all day here, everyone.
Yeah, it's some people dealing with a retinal detachment. Someone was on the Oculus. I think you guys are all going to be using the Oculus soon anyway. You're all going to be in virtual reality.
Do you think that would?
No, that's going to hurt your neck so much. I tried that at the P&E and it hurt my neck. It was heavy. That's going to be a problem, I think, coming up. They got to come up with a way to really lighten that load.
It will. That's how
what your spider friends are for. They'll make it. They'll put their web attached to your Oculus.
That's how it works.
Yeah.
That's technology.
It's a nice technology.
There's creepy clowns in it.
But what are you doing with it though? Like, you mean just waving your hands in the air and that they're somehow gonna have a result from that? I guess you can print it out.
Why not? You get your stick or whatever business and you draw in front of you and you're drawing.
But it doesn't seem like seems like you've put goggles in front of what you're already doing normally anyway.
But there's also the sculptors that are doing this thing where you basically
True.
The Oculus sculptor,
I could see as sculptor, as a sculptor.
There's also augmented reality, which is interesting, where your camera is kind of taking pictures of your surroundings and you're seeing like a live feed of everything around you, but the program that you're using incorporates that into your. So something comes up a copy or something flying around the room. It's in the room with you. So
no, that's all cool. I'm just wondering as an artist what, you know, how it's replacing already. We're already staring at a screen, moving your hand, moving a pencil on the screen.
I can't imagine what that's like.
If we're just staring into blank space and moving our hand in the air with a similar effect, I mean, it feels like you're just you're moving yourself farther and farther from the tactile element of art, which is also very appealing. I mean, I think, when you're a kid and you're just putting pencil on paper and you're just making circles and then you're filling in those circles and then you add more circles to those circles and then you have a character of some sort because it's all circles. You know, the reason we do that is because we like that feel of the pen on the paper. And then pretty soon you're just like staring into goggles with your hand moving in the air. I guess it's efficient, but it feels like...
It feels like I think there would be too much of a lag that noticeable.
At least for now.
Yeah.
I'm sure the technology could capture what it feels like to spray paint a wall, but that's not my medium. Yeah. I don't want to spray paint walls. So, you know, for me, it's a,
'cause I know a lot of people have
virtual graffiti artist.
With the Cintiqs and with the tablets because it's too smooth. Like, drawing on glass really often. Mm-hmm. So it's about finding
but you
a
like brush. You like vellum paper, which I don't.
I do like vellum paper. It's really, I can't draw on smooth paper.
See, I like smooth paper.
It's awful, but.
It's not awful.
It is.
It's just different.
No,
it's just different, Pia.
Can't do anything with it.
Embrace the smooth.
Oh, that is so not a Dave thing to say.
Embrace
smooth. How many things have you complained about that are like, not awful, it's just different? No.
Heather.
Let me play episode 65, David versus the Eagles.
There are ways that you can trick your brain out of that.
That is awful.
That when you get a good brush that simulates texture really well, or if you get a nib that has a little bit of a drag to it, then you don't notice that you're on glass.
I'm going to say that the thing that we've learned from today's episode is trick your brain.
Yeah, it's a lot of tricking your brain.
You do have to trick your brain.
I think that's even as you get older, too. You got to find ways to trick your brain to stay out of, like, ruts, because that's what kills you. That's what destroys brain cells. You got to constantly find new puzzles to do and then keep your brain working, or else it's going to end up in a nursing home drooling. So, you know, trick your brain.
Yep.
Well, it's funny. I was just thinking about...
Listen to us, Jacob Marley's.
Yes.
Link by link, we have destroyed our retinas.
Maybe this is going back too far now, but just thinking, it's funny that you said about how you write, and you need, because I love to write without any plan at all. Like, I just...
Me too.
You know, the mystery story that I'm sitting in a box, halfway done. I mean, that's... And I'm not blocked on it. I'm just no time on it. You know, that's the problem I'm having. But
who's the murderer in that, by the way?
No idea yet. I really no idea.
Oh, okay.
Murders happened, but I have no idea who murdered this person. And I feel like I'll get to the end of the story, and it'll happen. It'll come together.
Who was the police officer's partner?
It's not about a police officer. It's not about a police officer.
Okay.
There's a police officer, but he's kind of a bad guy in it. He's a bad guy, but he's not like he's not like part of the murder plot. He's not a helpful character. Okay. But yeah, it's just fun for me just to write. And I kind of have a general idea where I'm going, and I just kind of head wander, kind of meander towards that. And then I get there and I'm like, okay, now I've reached this part of the story. I'm halfway through, and now the murder's happened. And now we have to carry on, and I'll figure out as I go, you know, because I really had no idea when I started it, what it was going to be. And characters have come into it that I'm really liking, and they keep doing things. I'm always happy with what they're doing. And
also a meanderer.
Oh, yeah.
But I think that's... Yeah. It's not that you're meandering. Well, it's just that the characters are guiding the plot. The same way in life.
We meander through life.
I'm incredibly character-driven when it comes to stories, like any stories, and like movies, anything. And if the characters aren't strong, or if the motivations don't seem entirely dictated by what the character would do, it totally puts me off.
That's why I don't like a movie like Seven, because I feel like the movie has a moral that it wants to rub your nose in, and it just kind of grabs you by the nose and pulls you through and so the characters, no matter what the characters do, it will never affect the story, because the story is already set in stone to get to this point that the author wants to get to. Mm-hmm. And so everything that happens to get you to that point.
That's why I dislike 90% of all horror movies, because it has to get to the point where the monster is killed, or is it? And it doesn't matter, because whatever they did had no effect, and that just bugs me at the end of it.
Yeah, I can see that. I can see that, because it's also very formulaic
in
a way.
You can't be evil, my friend. Mm-hmm. It would always win. Well, then why'd I waste this entire reading this book, or seeing this movie,
and, but
or
that,
reading this comic?
But then that's what's fun about a film like Suspiria, where that just tosses plot out the window and just kind of takes you on this weird journey that eventually ends up in a sort of place, and you're kind of like, something happened. But at the same time, it's very aesthetically interesting and fun, and you know, and they never explain why there's a room full of barbed wire. Why was there a room for a barbed
wire? That's where I stopped watching movies. I was like, I can't deal with this anymore. This is just no. Just stick a ballerina in a room full of barbed wire. That's not fetishistically weird at all.
Hey, folks, why don't you let us
that
know
as an objection,
where you
but...
stop listening to this episode, too?
yes, wait. Good way to invite the lethal blow.
No, all I'm saying is they've clearly listened to this point, so they didn't stop listening.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah, so there
Well, you
go.
Fooled me.
All right, we got to wrap it up.
I am so dumb. Everybody.
Dave?
I want to tell you guys something that's happening. It's new, fairly new, recently new, newish. We have a Patreon thing that we're doing, and you are welcome to contribute if you'd like to, just to help us defray some of the expenses of doing this show. Ian's terrible heroin habit and my constant need for whiskey.
My delightful heroin habit.
And so you're welcome to go there. It's Sneaky Dragon. That's so simple to remember.
By the way,
and,
does anyone else in this room have a Patreon thing going on?
Oh, maybe. Man, you are such an interrupter. But anyway, yeah.
I just launched it last night, but... Yeah, I have a Patreon too. You can find it linked in the about page of Sable and Aster.
So. We will put a link to it as well on our page. So if you want to, you can go to Sable and Aster. You can go see the Critical Hit comics that Heather's done. You can go to her Patreon account and you can contribute there if you want, or you can go to ours. Man, that feels like we're competing against each other now.
Totally pick me.
Totally pick Heather. We don't need it. We're on the way out. We are over, everyone. This podcasting stuff, everyone knows that it's already being monetized through the roof.
Sorry, Dave, I was on the Oculus. What was going on? Yeah. I was just looking at creepy clowns mm-hmm. in my virtual reality space.
Sure.
Have you wrapped up the show yet?
Staring into the haunted mirror, is that what you meant?
Yeah, okay. I'll just put this back on. You keep going.
Yeah.
Ah, clowns!
You can contact us at SneakyD. Let me just say one more thing before we go. I just want to thank everyone for the questions last week. It was lots of fun doing that show, that crazy marathon that
we're
I can't.
Still doing it.
What I'm surprised.
It was that long, we are still doing the show.
What I'm surprised is that people were like writing that day and saying like, "I love the show." I'm like, "You listen to 4.5 hours in one day? What is wrong with you people?"
It's like slow TV.
It is. It's like slow TV. It's like watching those shows where they...
Those Norwegian shows about knitting.
Yeah, okay. I guess so. Yeah, thanks for comparing me to knitting, like, but...
I totally listened to it on Sunday all the way through, and I didn't necessarily plan on it. It was just so compelling, I had to keep listening. It was great. I loved it.
You guys are crazy. So, but thank you. Thank you for listening to that show. And thank you for everyone who's written and said nice things about it as well. I really appreciate it. I personally couldn't get through it all. I gave up at hour 3. Yeah. I was like, I'm done. I'm just posting the stupid thing.
And thanks to everyone who posted on our message board, including Nina Matsumoto, who just posted ellipses.
I think we killed her.
Did we?
I think that's what it meant. She's just like, I'm dead.
Done?
Yeah, I'm
that
done.
Makes sense.
I'm done.
All right.
Ghosts can only, type in ellipses.
That's right. I forgot about that.
We forgot about that rule.
That's why Casper only talks in ellipses.
That's right. Yeah. We're all trying to think of a pun for ellipses now. Everyone, can we do it?
What do you want?
What?
Our ellipses are sealed? Is that what you're looking at?
That's a good one.
Something like that?
That's
a
good one.
Is this the ellipses service we're paying here? Mm-hmm. What do you want?
Yeah. And so you can write to us at sneakyd@sneakydragon.com. You can go to our message board and leave a message underneath the show and say hi. You can go to Facebook, Sneaky Dragon. You can go to Twitter at @sneaky_dragon. And we have a Tumblr page that duplicates what I post on the website. Thank you for listening to the show, everyone. Thank you, Heather, for coming in today. Thank you, Pierre, for dropping by as well. And Ian, thank you for dropping by. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. I'm going to do a quick plug. If you're listening to this on either Saturday or Sunday, mm-hmm. both P and I are going to be at Edmonton Fan Expo signing stuff. And she'll be drawing things, and I'll be maybe having stuff in front of me or maybe not because I can't find my comps right now. So if I can, I'll be there with comics in front of me. Otherwise, but I'll also be performing with the 404s, who are a great improv group there.
Okay.
And we're doing Star Wars versus Star Trek improv. I got to find myself a Star Trek outfit sometime tonight. That's something I'm doing.
We were talking about this last week, doing this.
What?
Finding a Star Trek costume.
Yeah.
Still doing it.
Still
doing it. It's been a busy fucking week, bro. Okay.
You're right. It has been a busy week for you. No, come on. Am I Master Procrastinator? Am I going to really... Should I be the one who's...
That's what your DJ name is, yeah, Master Procrastinator.
Master Procrastinator.
Yeah, are you ready for some beats?
And ready for some beats.
I did not bring my records.
I did not bring...
But I promise next week, folks,
guys,
we're really going
to
get down.
I was going to go look for some records, and then I was like, started watching this TV show. I don't know if you guys have... Anyway.
Called The Get Down.
It's about a DJ. And it's pretty good. It's a pretty good show. Thanks, everyone. We'll see you next week.
Play the song, Dave.
I love the rat that lives under the floor and the same for you. The day will come soon when I look in your eyes, but I won't see you. I've got a head like a soaking sponge. I've got a tongue like a little slug. I won't be bugged by trivia. My cow, I love my Brian, my Dennis, and my owl. I can even find it in my heart to love my glove. Wish I could say the same for you. The day will come soon when I look in your eyes to see you smile.
Silence
is over. Silence is golden.
Silence complete.
All right.